short and sweet. That's what we've done with this episode of the Vermont Edition podcast. I'm Matthew Smith, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. NPR's Goats and Soda blog tells stories about life in a changing world, from health to transportation to farming. Last month, they reported on climate change from a unique perspective. They did it from the future. Reporter Dan Charles took the idea of reporting from the year 2050, looking back at how we stopped climate change, and he ran with it. Charles and the guests he interviewed all agreed that rapid change was necessary to overcome the civilization-level challenges posed by climate change. Here's Dan Charles imagining this post-climate change world of 2050 with engineer Scilla Killicott.
We electrified everything. Electric cars came first. That was actually pretty easy.
By 2025, the battery technology got cheaper.
Electric cars were no longer more expensive.
At that point, there was a massive shift to electric vehicles because they were quieter and they were cleaner and less maintenance costs. No oil change. Yippee, you know.
According to Dan Charles's reporting, heating and cooling in homes and offices also went electric many years ago. Power plants that burned gas and coal were replaced by solar and wind farms covering millions of acres. At Stanford University, the director of the university's Climate and Energy Project, Sally Benson, says that in 2050, her commute is not only electric, it's airborne.
I regularly take a helicopter, an electric helicopter from here to San Francisco.
You can run a helicopter on batteries?
Oh, yes, yes. Oh, God, that happened such a long time ago. Yeah, that happened in the 30s. Yeah, that was great.
Now, you know, Vermont is often slow to adopt new technologies. But in this case, here in 2050, we're ahead of the pack. Beta Technologies got its start at the Burlington Airport in the late 2010s, building electric vertical takeoff and landing vehicles, or eVTOLs. You heard about it back on this program, Vermont Edition, way back in 2019. But now that we're in 2050, Kyle Clark, one of the founders, says it's old hat to take one of these electric aircraft from Burlington to Stowe.
We're in downtown Burlington in 2050. You just received an in-ear notification that your husband is en route to Stowe, and your digital assistant, the granddaughter of Alexa and Siri, asked if you would like to meet him there in 11 minutes. You reply yes, and your route is planned. Your personal digital assistant directs you to the curb and sends the car to the appropriate vertiport, which is much like an airport but has no runways. There's a vertiport tucked atop the City Place in Burlington on Church Street. But to relieve air congestion in the city, you are heading to one of the centers of the Cloverleaf on the highway exit ramps at the intersection of I-89 and Williston Road. Stowe is 4 minutes by car and 7 minutes in the air. When your car arrives at the Cloverleaf, it slows and spirals inward to the drop-off. After not going through TSA, your personal digital assistant tells you which seat you are to step into of a four-seat aircraft with four large propellers on the top and one on the back. None of the propellers are moving. Two other passengers slide into their seats and both side doors slowly close. There are clear windows all around and a small screen in front of you with some thin eyeglasses on top of it. A voice confirms this aircraft is headed to Stowe and it rolls itself out onto a small pad off the side of the building. Without delay, the voice asks for confirmation that everyone is ready. It recognizes both head nods and voice response. After confirmation, the voice says, departing, all the safety pre-flights, including validating seat belts and airspace, were done automatically. From inside the aircraft, there's a hum, specifically tuned to minimize the human perception and annoyance. The aircraft accelerates upward and forward as the hum changes pitch to a whirr. You notice the lifting rotors stop, and the aircraft is moving forward towards Mount Mansfield at 150 miles per hour.
All right, I'm going to stop us there because before we get to Stowe, we're going to check in on some of the other ways Vermont has changed now that we're living in 2050. And listeners, please come along with us on this journey. We're going to spend the hour living in the future and looking back at how we got here, from climate change to agriculture to the different ways we envision work and offices and community here in 2050. So tell us what your Vermont looks like today in the year 2050, how your life is different. You can call 1-800-639-2211. Yes, I'm sad to say Vermont Edition still apparently uses landline technology here in the future. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.org. Over on Reddit, we've been getting a lot of thoughts on how different life is in Vermont in 2050. Leather Donut says Vermont is a suburb of Boston now. Snuffy Two Shoes writes retail weed is finally legal. Cold Colgate says Stowe lift tickets are $1,000 per day. Ignan Integra says with the declining population, real estate prices eventually came down. Doodlesworth says people are still complaining about mud season. And Potsy Ramirez writes, hey, we just got 5G. Meanwhile, iSkiVT says most ski areas closed back in 2035 when CO2 hit 500 parts per million. If not closed, they have a greatly shortened season on artificial snow. Skiing is only economically viable in a few high-altitude locations here in 2050. Let's go to Mish, who's calling in from Plainfield. Hi, Mish.
How are you, Jane? Fascinating topic. This last week in 2015, April of 2050, I noticed that the population of Vermont had climbed to 14 million. And the suburbs have now engulfed all of Plainfield and Northfield and Randolph and so on. The reason, of course, is that the rising sea level from the last decades finally swamped the seawalls that were futilely built around the coastal areas. And with the sea having risen 12 feet so far out of a possible 20 to 60, depending on which climatologist you look at, things have begun getting rough down there. We see a lot of increased crime. There's homelessness. Even the homeless people migrated. And so Vermont is no longer the lovely, rural, sparsely populated area. Burlington alone has now reached roughly 3 million people simply in the Burlington, the greater Burlington area, which now stretches from the Canadian border down well south into on route, what used to be Route 7 is now an interstate.
Well, Mish, so, boy, it is a big change, because I can remember back in 2019 when we had like 623,000 people and 3 million just in Burlington. Massive change on a massive scale in a very short period of time. Mish, I appreciate you sharing your perspective here in 2050. That's Mish Kabe, professor of computer security and information systems at Norwich University. Tenure must be amazing considering how long you've been at Norwich here now in 2050. And Mish, you're not the only one thinking about climate refugees. Mark and Jen say the cities to our south were flooded and are flooding Vermont with people. All of this alarm about Vermont losing people has been radically turned around. Our schools are over full and our rural communities are struggling with zoning issues, unprepared for the rapid population growth. However, our country stores are thriving. I hope that we are going to be able to maintain our wild spaces to allow wildlife to thrive during this rapid population growth. And Arkery Starkey on Reddit says, as the oceans rose and flooded New York and Boston, a ton of people moved inland. Everyone who thought they'd retire to the idyllic mountains took the opportunity. The population swung. Idealistic liberal flatlanders streamed in, and the skyrocketing demand for high-speed internet was matched by enough unemployed technical expertise to get local decentralized ISPs off the ground. Down in Brattleboro, we barely kept up with the new housing crunch, and finally taxing landlords enough on vacant apartments that they were forced to rent out every space. The time trade exploded into a thriving barter system, and local farms found cheap labor available at every turn. And we ended up with a thriving queer community and a series of active farming communes. Lots of different ideas here about Vermont in 2050. Some see rapid population growth, others see other things. Joining us now is Paul Costello, Executive Director of the Vermont Council on Rural Development. He also worked on the Council on the Future of Vermont. Paul, nice to see you here and be with you in Vermont in 2050. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Jane. Great to be here.
So, you know, a lot of people worried here about 2050 as we are in it because of all of these changes, because of climate change, because of population swings? How do you see it?
Well, I think that there's a collective imperative that has brought us to this point, that back in the 2019, there was deep concerns and a very broad sense of apocalyptic opportunity or apocalyptic probability from people. Lots of people were worried about climate change. Others were worrying about the state of like international tension. A lot of concerns about the future of democracy and the way that we work together as a society. And I think that what has happened in the last generation really has been that in 2050, we've come together with a cultural imperative around revisioning the American dream, re-envisioning and reaffirming Vermont ideals of patriotism of place, faith in democracy, affirmation of core values of freedom, justice, opportunity, economic opportunity for all. And that plus innovation, technology, welcoming our neighbors, welcoming newcomers to the state in line with the climate change results of the decline of the Oglala aquifer and flooding in Bangladesh, South Florida, New York, and Boston has really changed the population dynamic of Vermont. So,
you know, Paul,
we're responding. We've regenerated population in our village centers, but we also have a dynamic agriculture and forest products environment around them.
Well, what's so interesting is, you know, I hear the optimism you have in 2050, and even a Pew Research poll taken back in 2019 showed that there was a lot of pessimism about the future and specifically about the year 2050. But now that we're here, as you see it, you know, there has been a lot of rapid change, but there has been a lot of opportunity as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think that when you look at our village centers, you see that every downtown in Vermont is net zero. That roofs, walls, walkways, even roads are generating electricity. And everyone is part of an intelligent matrix of choices around clean energy, storage, and distribution. Our utilities are facilitators of that. Our transportation system is radically different because agriculture has expanded and our villages are more dense than before. More people are walking, riding bikes, and taking scooters. And there's jitneys and a robust electric transportation between communities. So we've really changed the way we move about. We've changed the way we generate energy. When you think about our downtowns, we still have things like bookstores, toy stores, hardware stores, places that people want to go to touch things, to pick them up, to feel them, to get the heft of that hammer before they buy it. And then there's ubiquitous, when you think about the opportunity of the global economy in a digital age, there's ubiquitous service providers who are connecting to companies globally, and they don't need to be in Mumbai to work for a company in Mumbai or China or San Francisco. They can live in downtown Barrie and participate, but they want to be with other people. So a lot of downtown buildings are repurposed as sort of innovation centers or co-working places where people are bumping elbows with others and creating new products or working for companies all around the world.
How about those wild spaces, Paul? I mean, you know, the downtowns, I can remember back in 2010s when we were worried about the vitality of our downtowns, and it's so great that they are all so strong and vital now. But there has also been over the years, as we've transitioned to a different kind of economy, this concern about our wild spaces and having landscapes that that still allow for untrammeled wildlife corridors. And I'd love for you to describe what you see out your window.
Well, people have been working for generation and a half now to preserve wildlife corridors, and they've done it very wisely. At the same time, because of the global population growth and the need for more food, plus it's warmer in Vermont and drier, it's warmer in Vermont and wetter and drier out west, we're called upon to grow much more food. So agricultural lands have opened up. And meanwhile, the forest products resources are more valuable than ever, and we're doing a lot of creativity in products development and so forth. So the rural economy is strong, but we've also had the wisdom and the foresight to preserve and protect particular lands, even as we've had the growth of these two industries and outdoor recreation. We see now that Vermont is a mecca for mountain bikers, skiers, snowboarders, People who are using non-motorized recreation, because carbon-based recreation is pretty much over in 2050. And that has brought a lot of energy and a lot of youth and excitement to Vermont. We're a healthy place partly because of it. We're all participating in it.
And boy, aren't you and I glad now that we are senior citizens that there are so many young people here to help keep our economy strong and our lives vital. Paul Costello is executive director of the Vermont Council on Rural Development. And way back in the day, he worked on the Council on the Future of Vermont, which we are now in. Paul, nice to have you with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Jane.
Novelist M.T. Anderson tweeted in, "By weird coincidence, my novel is about what it's like in Vermont in 2050. Basically, there's all this incredible tech, but it's elsewhere. So up here, it's still just pickup trucks and mud." 50 or Below on Reddit says, "By 2050, we've expanded internet access across the state. This makes real estate more desirable, running a business viable, and working remotely possible. There's a heavy shift to telecommuting and remote work, saving time, money, and lowering our carbon footprint. This sparks a slow but steady increase in growth in smaller towns. Working and living in the same location versus commuting means local businesses make a comeback. The separation of work life and home life erodes to support community values and introduces out-of-state transplants to the idea of valuing your community and your neighbors. People begin to appreciate simpler and more genuine lifestyles and eye Vermont as their new home." Oh, you know, it's been a few minutes since Kyle Clark took off on his electric aircraft from Burlington to Stowe. Let's check back in on that journey.
The aircraft is moving forward towards Mount Mansfield at 150 miles per hour. You tap your small screen and put on a pair of augmented reality glasses. Entertainment is now blended with your real physical space as an exciting story about logging in Underhill in the 1850s is told, and historical events are overlaid on the real landscape below. There is no pilot. Over your head, there's a red lever labeled emergency. This deploys a GPS-guided emergency parachute. Next to it, there's a button that says TOC, which enables you to reroute the aircraft in case of an emergency. To your right, there's a nervous passenger. You lean over and push the button that says Info on their screen. Their directional speakers talk through the flight and preemptively advise the passenger before every turn and descent as the aircraft plots a minimum energy glide into the vertiport in downtown Stowe. Just as you see the leaves on the trees, the overhead propellers turn, and the whirr turns back into a hum as the aircraft arrests its descent and lands softly at the center of the pad. At the adjacent helipad, your husband steps out of a similar vehicle, and you walk together down the carless street to dinner, knowing you'll be home at 6:30 in Grand Isle, the same time your kids get home from practice.
That's Kyle Clark, a team leader with Beta Technologies, sharing what short-range transportation is like here in 2050. And we're going to take a deeper look at transportation in Vermont and how we got to this electrified present day. Neil Lunderville is the former Secretary of Transportation and Administration under Governor Jim Douglas and former General Manager of Burlington Electric Department. He's also the President and Chair of the Preservation Trust of Vermont. Hi, Neil. It's nice to have you with us here.
It's wonderful to be here.
How did you get to our studio today?
We stopped owning a car about 15 years ago. With our neighbors, have a shared service, a car share type service, and a great electric vehicle whenever we need it, we just go on our phones and say, "I want to take it out." I signed that out, drove over, parked in one of the spots. You know, we haven't plugged our cars in for so many years now. We just drive over the pad and it wirelessly recharges our car, even though I'm not really worried about it. I mean, we have a 1,000-mile range on our cars now. So,
do you remember when it was wild to have a 250-mile range?
I do remember.
And it took hours to recharge?
I know, we laugh about it. I mean, range anxiety has sort of become a punchline for so many jokes these days. But in fact, we don't even worry about it. I recently drove with my family and my grandkids down to Washington, D.C., and we drove around for the whole weekend, only recharged the car once.
What do your grandkids think about the idea that every adult wanted to own a car way back in the day?
I mean, they think it's hilarious.
Really?
Oh, well, we pull out the the photos of my first car, this land yacht that was about 6 miles per gallon of gasoline back when we used gasoline, and they just think it's the funniest thing ever. I think they see it as a record player. Like when I was growing up, people moved to CDs and then nobody played records anymore.
Now you're with ancient technology.
Oh, seriously, ancient technology. But that's the amazing part of 2050. Looking back, some of these things that we took for granted for 100 years in America are totally different now. I mean, of course we still drive, but I don't drive anywhere near it. No one I know drives as much as they used to. I'm so excited to hop on an e-bus, which have been around for now 25 years, pretty prevalent. I've been riding my e-bike everywhere, especially as I got older. E-bikes became a really good substitute for my regular bicycle. And
having that little extra push is helpful.
Yeah, especially up some of those Vermont hills. They haven't changed at all in the last 30 years. So I've been able to use that a lot more. And, now with autonomous vehicles really coming into their own, if I want to go to Montpelier, I'll just get on the interstate and set Montpelier and, have a good 25 minutes in my car, catching up on the local news and, chatting with my friends without worrying about any of the real things I used to when commuting back and forth to Montpelier.
Neil, back when you were a young gun in Vermont politics, it seemed like a stretch to have these ambitious energy portfolio goals that we were supposed to reach by 2050. Do you remember back then and how we got from there, from these worries about a carbon neutral future to the carbon neutral present that you're in here?
I do. And looking back all those years ago, I think back and think of all kind of some of the unnecessary hand-wringing that we did. The technology, certainly in the 20s, the technology really started to blossom, but it had been coming for quite some time. We saw in the early 21st century this small-scale generation and storage of electricity with solar panels and batteries really started to take hold by the 20s, and then certainly in the 30s, it took off. And we were able to generate more electricity than we needed and store it for a long period of time. That alone wasn't an enabling technology. We needed one more step, which folks remember now it's kind of second nature, but the blockchain technology, where we're able to do secure digital record keeping. And I think around 2030.
Here in 2050, I still don't understand blockchain, I have to say. But I'm glad that
Don't even worry about it. It's inside. It's all in there. It all works. But, now since 2035, where every kilowatt that's produced has basically its own digital barcode, I'm my own generation station at home, and we produce enough electricity to help our neighbors. We haven't lost power in a storm for 20 years now. I don't think anybody in Vermont's lost power for about 20 years. The electric grid itself is resilient, it's self-healing, and it finds ways to share electricity much like the internet does to share data. And that's one of the real kind of core enabling technologies that allowed electric vehicles and a lot of other great technologies to really work in 2050.
But we're not alone here in Vermont, because we would be seeing all of those enormous storms and still be seeing all of the ravages of climate change if Vermont was the only place that had sort of brought this electric technology and carbon neutral technology to the fore. So we're part of a big network here.
Oh, we are. But it's happened everywhere. And it's picked up as soon as electric vehicles move to the 300 to 400 miles in range, and as soon as the charging technologies became a little easier, the wireless helped a lot. Just drive into your garage and it suddenly charged overnight. You'd have to plug it in. Didn't have to worry about setting it. The system sort of worked that all out.
That seemed unbelievable in 2019, where people like me living in rural Vermont didn't even have strong internet connections.
It did seem unbelievable, but certainly Moore's Law has held for many years. And the technology itself is doubling every 18 months. Technology is on a slower course, but it's been enabled by this digital technology, which keeps moving at a rapidly expanding pace. So back in 2019, when we thought, oh, all these steps I have to do to charge my car, by 2025, there are almost no steps. You drove your car into the garage, you shut the garage door, it automatically started charging at midnight when the draw on the overall electric grid was much lower. And then by the time you went back in the morning, your car was fully charged. But you really didn't need to charge it anyway, because you already had 500 miles of range. That's the beauty of it. The battery technology just has continued to evolve, and things that we thought, well, I'll never do better than lithium ion. I mean, lithium ion, that's old news. They're using these solid state technologies now. They're small batteries. They're able to use them in all kinds of applications. And I just can't wait for what the next 30 years will hold.
Well, I know you have to give your neighbor your car because you signed it out for a short amount of time. So I won't keep you, although we could talk about this forever because it's so interesting to think back to 2019, 30 years ago, and how different things are now. So, Neil, thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, it's got to be. Next time I come in, I'll probably be a hologram.
Good. So, I can't wait for that.
Okay, great.
Neil Underville is former Vermont Secretary of Transportation and Administration under Governor Jim Douglas. He was also General Manager of Burlington Electric Department way back in 2015 through 2018. Liz says, we're much more diverse now. People from all over the world found a welcoming and warm home here. We've got a female governor and an all-female congressional delegation with women and people of color in roles throughout the public and private sector. Our small towns are thriving with plenty of small businesses, farms, and value-added agriculture and food. But DWOFF does not see the same future and writes, all the fish have died in Lake Champlain due to the smell and the inability to swim in it. Houses along the lake have all been abandoned because pollution into the lake never stopped. We have a note from Big Time Sauce, who says in 2050, the phrase Vermont economy won't have been uttered for 20 years. The colleges took care of themselves, one small school at a time. Now it's just UVM or Middlebury. Dairy globally declined and Vermont was hit hard. Some increased pressure from the climate didn't help. And under the guise of tempering the state's substance use issues, our hand-wringing legislature embraced the ban of alcohol statewide. Meanwhile, Beth Chuzansky with Building Bright Futures sends this postcard from 2050. Vermont spent about a generation building a child care system that aligns the needs of children with the needs of skilled child care professionals. Looking back, it's hard to imagine how we all survived the old system. It took a long time to grow the number of child care spots, but now the slots and the number of children needing care are aligned. Young families are growing, and the effects on Vermont's economy can't be understated. Parents work in high-growth sectors like tech, medicine, and education, and they work full-time knowing their children are cared for in an environment that's safe and nurturing. If the state had not taken steps to help early educators pay for their education back when the wage scale was lower, none of this could have happened. In 2050, Vermont's children are now arriving to kindergarten with a strong social, emotional, and educational foundation. And Chris Recchia is still alive. He's former Commissioner of Public Service calling in from Randolph. Hi, Chris. Nice to talk with you in 2050.
Hey, Jane. Hello. Unfortunately, I seem to, in 2050, have the same cold I had in 2019. So my
That's disappointing.
Voice is a little
off, but oh, I'm so sorry.
It is. It comes and goes. But, you know, there you go. But I am just delighted, as Neil and Paul have said before, that, you know, that our best expectations and policy directives that we tried to do in the 2000s and 2020 era were just so underestimating the advances that would occur. And, you know, it provided guidance and great direction. But ultimately, I'm amazed at 92 years old how amazing advances things have been. And I'm very, very pleased with that and proud of Vermonters for the direction that they've taken. The other thing I would say is, as a small organic farm owner, I'm still organic, and the sheep aren't any smarter. But instead of going out at lambing time and having to spend all night out with them, I've got this amazing technology that notifies me when one of them is in labor and helps them out, and it's really great. So I can actually sleep through the night.
Oh, I'm so glad. And at 92, sleeping through the night is a challenge anyway. So, Chris, well done on all of that. And thank
Good
you for
point.
Calling in. Thanks for sharing your perspective.
Course.
And I hope by 2070, your cold is gone. Chris Recchia,
well,
former commissioner.
I think by 2070, if I'm 92 and 2050, that by 2070, it definitely will be gone.
Well, yep. Yes, let's hope one way or another. Chris Recchia, thanks very much. Jeff is calling in from Winooski. Hi, Jeff. What's your 2050?
Oh, hi, Jane. So I'm thinking, like, we can get some of this started now, and I'm thinking about the airport, and I feel like it could be moved, and it could be in Milton by then. And where the airport is now, we have beautiful bungalows, and we have a bike system that takes people straight into Centennial Woods and right into downtown Burlington, and we have, like, an electric train. And so I'm hopeful for that. And I just thought I'd throw it out there, because if we're growing this city, you know, we're not going to have airplanes coming right in like a mile from the city center. So I think that would be great to see that area where the airport above, where the flat land above the river could just be a place for people to live.
Yeah, Jeff, thanks for that. I appreciate hearing your perspective. I remember when the Burlington International Airport moved out to Milton. Big changes. And that greenscape that you talk about now in South Burlington, where the old airport was, pretty amazing to think about. Let's talk to Robin Lunge, a member of the Green Mountain Care Board and former legislative counsel who's worked on health care reform in Vermont under Governor Peter Shumlin. Shumlin, if you remember, was governor way back in the early part of the century. Robin's with us now. It's nice to talk with you, Robin.
Nice to speak with you, Jane.
You know, it's 2050. I'm 71 years old. Chris Recchi is 92. And both Chris and I rely on the healthcare system a little bit more than we did back in the early days. I mean, I was just 40 in 2019. How about you? What's changed for you in our healthcare system?
Well, as you heard from Chris, we have not yet solved the common cold, but that's the anomaly in healthcare. At this point in healthcare, what we call healthcare in 2019, we would now in 2050 call sick care. And we really have changed our focus to health. So with advances in technology, such as being able to use a telemedicine or telehealth, which involves talking on your phone with your provider, having your wearable device like a Fitbit on steroids transmit your data to your provider, you can actually do many common visits with your provider from home or from your workplace if you have the privacy there. But we still have in-person options, and those in-person options look a lot more like a health campus. So where before a lot of our bricks and mortar is focused around ensuring that we have a place for people to go when they're not feeling well, because of new advances in gene therapies and technology, we can catch a lot of that sooner. And what in 2019 would put you in the hospital for a number of days now is a same-day procedure.
You know, one of the things that was so challenging in 2019 was dealing with our mental health care. And we have a note from Arcus Malkovey who writes, mental health support, especially for addicts, isn't even up for debate in 2050. It's just accepted and normal that if you're not feeling well, you can and should go see a doctor to talk it out. It's a combination of a strong push to educate the public that mental health issues don't make folks more violent and a continued normalization of seeing therapists when you're struggling, when no one has to worry about how much it'll cost to get medical care or fill a prescription, the number of folks forced into self-medicating their way to an addiction drops. No one born after 2020 even remembers the day when it was otherwise. So can you talk us through that, Robin? Because a lot of us who were alive in 2020 do remember after Tropical Storm Irene and this major focus on reworking our mental health system, but it was not smooth or easy.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the big advances in 2050 is that we've really tackled the stigma associated with mental health issues and substance abuse. And so now it's really seen as another type of illness, just like if you break your arm or you have any other kind of physical health illness. And so I think in the healthcare of the future, in 2050 and where we are now, we will see really a no wrong door approach. So if my major health concern relates to a mental health issue, I'll be able to either do a video chat with a therapist, which even in 2019 has very promising evidence behind it, or I'll be able to make that in-person connection with a therapist, and that'll be much easier to access. I'll be able to see a therapist in the same place as my primary care or vice versa. So I may go in for a therapy appointment, and if I need to have some sort of physical checkup, do that in the same location. And similarly, in what we have in our health campuses, where we will still have some inpatient hospital facilities, because I think we will still need those in 2050, particularly with an aging population, it'll be much more seamless and easier to have the care that you need, regardless of what type of care that is.
Well, it's really interesting to look back on how much has changed and yet how much still has stayed the same in terms of needing a personal touch sometimes and that face-to-face communication with our healthcare professionals. Robin Lunge is a member of the Green Mountain Care Board and a former legislative counsel who worked on healthcare reform under Governor Peter Shumlin. Robin, thank you very much for talking to us about healthcare here in 2050.
Thank you.
We are talking about life in 2050 Vermont right now. Judith says the old church buildings are now used as schools. The new places of worship are round structures, and all spirituality share one space. It's easy for kids or anyone to visit their Muslim, Jewish, Christian, New Age neighbors. And on Friday nights, we all get together. Christina says back in the 20s, there was a shift toward perennial foods and permaculture practices that helped sequester carbon and revitalize soil. Food was planted in public common areas as well. And do you remember back in the early 21st century when we were talking a lot about what farming would look like and the future of farming in Vermont? There was plenty to discuss, from how agriculture contributed to the pollution problem in Vermont's waterways to the economic viability of dairy. Amazing to think back to that time. But let's talk about where we are now. Liz Gleason is program manager for the Vermont Farm and Forest Viability Program under the Vermont Housing and Conservation Board, and her work focuses on improving the economic viability of Vermont's farm and forest businesses. Liz, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I know we've actually caught you in a grocery store, not in our studio, although you have great quality sound for being on a phone. Can you describe where you are in the grocery store and what it looks like?
Sure. So today, grocery stores look a little bit different than they did 30 years ago, but we still have them. We really moved towards a focus to just having more fresh food in grocery stores, because there's so many other ways to get your other products as a consumer, whether it's on the internet or getting delivered by some kind of electric helicopter. We have lots of ways to buy things, but people still care about being able to choose their fresh food. We still have farmers markets. We still have general stores, like one of our callers mentioned. And I can still buy Vermont products here from the farmers that I've been working with for the past 35 years.
So all those worries that maybe we were just going to have all of our food delivered right to our doorstep from Chile and California didn't really come to fruition.
Well, I think you certainly could if you wanted to. There's still plenty of ability to buy almost whatever you want from anywhere in the world. But there's a lot of consumers who still feel really connected to their landscape. And because we've come to a realization as a state and more globally too, the relationship between climate change mitigation and agriculture, more consumers do feel sort of connected to agriculture and interested in buying local products.
Liz, my mind is a little fuzzy since I'm aging so rapidly today. So remind me, there were some moments earlier in this century when it really looked like agriculture was in trouble, and dairy in particular was a struggling sector with low milk prices, an economy of scale that didn't really work for Vermont when it came to federal policies, and then, of course, pollution problems that we had to work really hard to address. So can you remind me how we made these changes?
Yeah, I think we have done such a great job as a state in approaching these challenges. But it was really hard, particularly in the 2020s. Throughout the early 2000s, we really saw a decline in the dairy industry. We lost hundreds of farms. And because dairy was really the backbone of Vermont agriculture up until that point, it had an effect on the ability of other kinds of farms to succeed. But for a couple reasons, we were able to weather that. One, because we had invested so much as a state in conserving our agricultural land. So we really had a base of land that wasn't developed. It didn't have pressure to be turned into houses. And we were able to use that land for other kinds of agriculture going forward. So that was an exciting investment that the state made really over the past 100 years that has come to fruition now. And one really, really exciting development that's helped the agricultural industry and really helped farmers have a more viable livelihood in that business is that we have found a method to pay for what's called ecosystem services. So in addition to producing all different kinds of food, we still make maple, beef, cheese, we produce hemp, we produce veggies, we still do all of that. But it's still hard to make money at that because farming is a difficult business and continues to be so in 2050. But farmers who are managing their land well are also really providing other public benefits that way back in 2020 we didn't pay for at all. So, for example, grazing operations, really great grazing operations that are producing grass-fed beef, they're also improving the soil so that when we have all these extreme weather events like we do now, heavy rainfalls, unpredictable rainfall, that land is able to absorb so much more water than it was in 2020, meaning that we don't have to invest in as much in our stormwater mitigation, meaning we don't have as much flooding in our downtowns. So we found a mechanism to actually pay farmers for the other services they provide to the public, and that has really helped.
Well, I know you have to get off to your farm. You said you were going to get an electric vehicle when you left the grocery store, and I know you've gone through the checkout, so I'm going to let you go. But Liz, I really appreciate you sharing your perspective here on farming in the present day, 2050. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Liz Gleason is Program Manager for the Vermont Farm and Forest Viability Program. That's under the Vermont Housing and Conservation Board. And we are living in the future today. And joining us last before we leave the future present is Christopher Kaufman Ilstrup, Executive Director of the Vermont Humanities Council. Hi, Christopher. Nice to talk with you.
Hey, Jane. How are you doing?
I'm well. And, you know, I've been so curious because all this year you've been launching these big 2050 events around the state on the subject of who is a Vermonter. And I'd love to get an update on how those have been going around the state, what you're hearing about who is a Vermonter here in 2050.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that we've been really trying to talk about this year is how we have finally gotten to a place where we understand that Vermonters are not defined by how many generations you've lived here. It's not measured by your skin color. It's not measured by what you do for a living, but it's measured really by the love of the place and the love of the community and by your investment in the community and what you are doing to help your community thrive. So, you know, one of the things that we have been doing, for example, is really celebrating all the refugee communities that have existed in Vermont for the last 30, 40, 50 years, going back to the first Bosnians that came to Vermont in the 1990s and then the Vietnamese community after that. But certainly we've seen, you know, there's been a lot of trouble with climate change refugees. We've seen other new communities come in as well, and we've learned how to welcome those people. And that's a really important thing for us.
You know, I've been laughing, too, at some of your introductions and some of the speeches you've been giving around the state here about way back in, you know, the 2010s when we sort of had this division between the arts and the sciences. And, you know, STEM was a big topic back then. And you've been talking more about the integration of all those things.
Sure. Yeah. You know, that has been a big challenge for us. 30, 40 years ago, there was often a sense that technology was the way of the future and it was the only jobs that you should be looking for were jobs in the STEM sector, science, technology, engineering, and math. And I think we've come a long way in the 30 years since then to understand, and I think many scientists have always understood this, that critical thinking and a love of the humanities is actually a critical piece of understanding how to be a good citizen. And we've come a long way around that, that really all of our universities, all of our colleges are now emphasizing that integration. One of the things that I'm excited about is that we were a big part of helping to get civics education back in high schools, back in middle schools, back in elementary schools, and that today we have ways for even the youngest citizens, even the kids in preschool, to be involved in making their community a better place. And that as they grow, they learn more about the Constitution, about the Founding Fathers, about the work that needs to happen now to organize around healthy communities.
Yeah, that was a big change when my kids got to high school, that mandatory civics education. I remember that. Christopher Kaufman Ilstrup is the longtime serving executive director of the Vermont Humanities Council. Christopher, thank you so much for just giving us a taste of life here in 2050.
Thanks, Jane. It's great to hear from all of my friends that I've been working with for so many years now, Paul and everybody else. And we're excited to turn it over to the next generation.
Yes, we are. And it's amazing the longevity here of the, you know, the powerful leaders in Vermont have been leaders now for more than 30 years. I want to thank all of our guests today and the people who called and wrote in for joining us on this journey to the future to imagine what Vermont might be like in 30 years. It's been fun.